This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is also brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and entering promo code PEL. You are listening to the Partially Examined Life, episode 136, part 2, where we're talking about Adorno and Horkheimer's The Culture Industry, Enlightenment as Mass Deception. And last time we introduced what he was doing. He's giving this Marxist critique and how the culture industry is the entertainment industry, but it's really connected to the rest of the economy and it's all crushing us into uniformity. And we got a little bit into what is distinctive about works of art that make them objectionable in this way. Is it the content? Is it the form? I think mostly now we're going to talk more about different kind of works of art and how the whole thing ties together. So I think we haven't talked yet about style. We talked already about content and how maybe the content doesn't matter, but style is supposed to be one of the things, the ways that really uniformity gets imposed.
Yeah, so page 100 is where this all begins. Here he's also arguing against another kind of thesis that seems plausible in the face of it, which is that the changes in style from the traditional, or what he's calling liberal society, are a matter of quote-unquote exhaustion of energy. This is a case in which he's going to have a more interesting explanation. So in other words, it's not the fact that we've simply fallen away from artistic tradition and nature. That's the whole exhaustion of energy idea. It's not the case that we have simply gotten lazier and less disciplined artistically. That's the idea he's going to argue against.
I think now's a good time to go to the text. So he's talking about the role of style and how style's a promise and how great artists have been mistrustful of style. And he gets to the point where he says, instead of exposing itself to this failure in which the style of the great work of art has always negated itself, the inferior work has relied on its similarity to others, the surrogate of identity. The culture industry has finally posited this imitation as absolute. Being nothing other than style, it divulges style's secret, obedience to the social hierarchy.
What I really liked about Adorno is the stuff that he hits in passing here, that he's obviously a really good philosopher about art, about music, and what makes it work. But he just raises these positive things only in passing, in contrast to what's wrong with now. He says right before this, in every work of art, style is a promise. In being absorbed through style into the dominant form of universality, into the current musical, pictorial, or verbal idiom, what is expressed seeks to be reconciled with the idea of the true universal. So it's kind of confusing a little bit. The true universal, what would be with just what happens to be prevalent in the culture at the moment. This promise of the work of art to create truth by impressing its unique contours on the socially transmitted forms is as necessary as it is hypocritical. By claiming to anticipate fulfillment through their aesthetic derivatives, it posits the real forms of the existing order as absolute. So that's just what I exactly was saying. The real forms of the existing order is just whatever the style prevalent in the culture happens to be, but absolute is all art is kind of pushing towards universality. To this extent, the claims of art are also ideology. Yet it is only in this its struggle with tradition, a struggle precipitated in style, that art can find expression for suffering. The moment in the work of art by which it transcends reality cannot indeed be severed from style. That moment, however, does not consist in achieved harmony, in the questionable unity of form and content, inner and outer, individual and society, but in those traits in which the discrepancy emerges in the necessary failure of the passionate striving for identity. So that's a really interesting and offhand description. That deserves like a whole chapter by itself of to decode this. But what it sounds like is you're trying to express an emotion. Like, you know, of course, I'll just use a song as an example, but because this is sort of what he's most directly talking about, but through a painting or whatever. And the tools that you have to do that are stylistic tools that you learned, you know, that are in the culture, whatever. And so let's say you use the blues. What would be bad about the way style gets applied now? Like if you, I'm going to put out a blues record, then like, well, unless you sound just like old, like previous blues, that's not going to work. You're not even doing blues anymore. Or the country purists are not going to accept you as country unless you're really doing a damn good imitation. Unless you're singing with that damn accent, that Southern accent. But what really makes something work effectively to demonstrate suffering is when there's a tension. That really what you're trying to express is the inexpressible. You're trying to express something that can't be put into words, that can't be put into any form whatsoever. But yet you're having to use these tools that are on hand, whether verbal or musical or whatever the art is, to do it. And it's that tension that he thinks that is part of what makes things great.
Yeah, the tension is between form and matter, right? Form and subject matter. The whole argument here is that like these classical forms, when you choose a form for a work of art, you're not simply trying to achieve formal perfection. That's not its motivation. It is a means of struggle. It's a way of, or he calls it a rigor against the chaotic expression of suffering. So for instance, you might think of the sort of energy a violinist puts into a really vigorous classical piece. That same energy, if it weren't formally structured, would just be chaos. It might just be something, an insane person screaming at the top of their lungs. So you want to be able to express that. You want to be able to sort of express your insanity in the face of suffering. And the form is the means of doing that. And the whole point is to have a tension between the form and that expression. Whereas with the culture industry products, the form is sort of part of the syntax of both of them from the very beginning. It's impressed on both what's being expressed and on the formal structure of what's being expressed at the bottom level. Like that's what he talks about around page 101. Even the very artistic syntax is infected with mechanical reproducibility. Does that make sense? Or?
Well, it sounds a little bit different than what Mark was talking about. I thought that Mark was talking about the internal tension between the strictures. Maybe it's related, but the rules of the genre and the tension of making something within those rules. Is that what you mean?
Instead of exposing itself to this failure, the style of the great work has always negated itself. It leaves a lot of room for interpretation. So I think Wes's interpretation and my interpretation both work perfectly well, and there's probably another treatise that makes this a lot more clear. I can see what Wes was just saying about the conflict between form and content. I think it would work, especially when you're just talking about an instrumental piece. I mean, is the content really just the emotional energy? I'm not sure that seems like it might be a matter of form and form. I guess the examples that he would probably have in mind match more closely to what Wes is talking about, because what I was thinking of is just forms of art in which there's room for improvisation. But everything he has to say about jazz, and I think would probably work for any other art form that involves improvisation, is wholly negative. So I'm not sure if there's room for, I'm doing the blues, but I'm doing it in my own way. It's more a matter of what already established song are you playing and how exactly are you doing it?
And are you doing it most like the way it ought to be done?
Right, right.
And his criticism of a jazz musician doing Beethoven was exactly along the lines you just mentioned, that you, rather than trying to render Beethoven most Beethoven, which is the proper thing to do, and that would be rendering it beautiful, you subvert it, but in not a way that, well, I guess this is where I find it a little bit confusing, is when he says, to this extent, the claims of art are always also ideology. I take him to be then saying that two things are happening in a significant work of art is, on the one hand, it's couched in an ideology, and then internally, it's also representing a kind of counter ideology that it's rubbing against the one that it's couched in. And that's part of what makes it sort of, it's a self-commentary, and that way it annihilates itself. So it would be like saying a country song ends up not really being a country song.
Because it transcends genre, because it's just so awesome.
Yeah. But then when he has something, his criticism of a jazz musician doing Beethoven, it seems like there's something about the improvisation present in jazz, which is either not an ideology or is so much just a heap of miscellaneous note making that it can't actually do that work. I don't completely get it, but.
So I think the sentence before the mention of ideology is important. By claiming to anticipate fulfillment through their aesthetic derivatives, it posits the real forms of the existing order as absolute. To this extent, the claims of art are always ideology. The idea is that to the extent that you think of, so culture industry posits the forms as absolute, but real art, understands that you are struggling against that very form, your attempt to express yourself. So this idea, yet it is only in the struggle with tradition, a struggle precipitated in style, that art can find expression for suffering. So you struggle against these forms that you've been handed down, you know, it could be sonnet form, or I don't know exactly what he's thinking about here, but it's in that tension between what you're doing with your specific subject matter and, let's see, your stylistic deviations, let's say, your struggle with tradition, that you can get this expression for suffering. If you simply say, I'm going to be formulaic, here are the forms, let's follow the form, then you're no longer doing that. You've collapsed all the tension.
But in a funny way, the cultural industry that he's criticizing has a kind of form which is utterly whatever it can be or necessarily be. So in a funny way, it's like having no boundaries at all to rub up against.
How do you mean?
Maybe, yeah, he doesn't think of it this way. I mean, he thinks of it being very, very strict and such that you'll be cast out and therefore there's no speaking within it. What happens when you have genuine freedom from, or the notion that the more political freedom you have, the less possibility there is for great art, simply because there isn't enough to rub up against?
Exactly. He starts out by saying every style that we inherit, the traditions, are expressions of social coercion. As an artist, your inventiveness doesn't rest on you being totally innovative. That would just be chaos. That's part of his point here. But it does rest on you taking these inherited forms and then struggling against them. But in the culture industry, you simply just accept the inherited form and run the piece of art according to that formula.
And I know it sounds like that it's a counterexample to say, oh, but shouldn't the jazz musician be then, you know, expressing himself based on, instead of just reproducing Beethoven? But his objection to this seems to be that he thinks that all jazz musicians, and again, we probably have to read more of the many negative things he has to say about jazz. I know he has a whole book, Introduction to the Sociology of Music, that I looked at one point, that the whole thing seems to be just ripping on jazz. Here he seems to be equating, saying the same things are wrong with the most high-level jazz. Like, he acknowledges that there's an avant-garde kind of jazz and the lowest class. But in this context about Beethoven, it's that he thinks that the way that one would change Beethoven would be so utterly predictable that you'd have to just syncopate it in a certain way, and you'd be kind of super, if you do play on the beat, you'd do it with a sneer, you'd do it with a self-satisfied, superior air, because that's just the image of the jazz musician and their relationship to things, that you are, even though, again, it seems like it's rebellious, you are completely conforming in doing that. It's totally unimaginative.
Yeah, go to page 101 where it's this imitation. It's pseudo-natural. It's pseudo for him. The improvisation of it is, you know, this is at, I think, the bottom of 101 or somewhere towards the middle.
Well, the top of 101, if he jazzes up Mozart, he changes the music not only where it is too difficult or serious, but also where the melody is merely harmonized differently, indeed more simply than is usual today.
So at the very bottom of 101. So a jazz musician who has to play a piece, okay, that is the Beethoven thing, syncopates. So it doesn't have to, I mean, it really doesn't have to be Beethoven. It could be any jazz, I think, where there's this syncopation and even improvisation, this deviation from form, right? Which is, that's such naturalness. He's calling it naturalness because it's supposed to be more like real life, right? Real life isn't so structured. Such naturalness, complicated by the ever more pervasive and exorbitant claims of the specific medium, constitutes the new style, quote unquote, he's quoting someone else here, a system of non-culture to which one might even concede a certain unity of style if it made any sense to speak of a stylized barbarism. So I think what he's objecting here to is the sort of, there's no real struggle in jazz, according to him. I'm not saying this. There's the sense in which you're pretending to be natural, or you're imitating the more chaotic, less formal features of life, is not really what goes on in art. You need the form. You need the sort of totalitarian or socially coercive form to resist that expressively. So again, it's about lack of tension. You need artificiality.
I did not listen to enough Charlie Parker.
Yeah. It's really hilarious to me that, like, Orson Welles and jazz are like decadent.
Well, actually, the way I was reading the thing about Orson Welles is again, you might pull out somebody like Orson Welles as an exception. Like, no, Orson Welles was a genius. He's not just obeying the rules of the craft. In fact, right, the next page, he talks about Orson Welles. The great influence of this stylization may already be more binding than the official rules and prohibitions. A hit song is treated more leniently today if it does not respect the 32 bars of the or the compass of the ninth than if it includes even the most elusive melodic or harmonic detail which falls outside the idiom. In other words, there are some ways you could be rebellious that are okay with the culture industry because they're not really rebellious. If you did something weird harmonically, if you were like Schoenberg, then you would be castigated. So next sentence, Orson Welles is forgiven all his offenses against the usages of the craft because, as calculated rudeness, they confirmed the validity of the system all the more zealously.
So for instance, Orson Welles used to create like a pit within the scene so he could get down low. He has all those camera shots, which are very, very low coming up. They're very dramatic because it's him curled up in this pit shooting upwards, right, at the characters. Or it's the whoever's holding the camera, which is, I think, him sometimes. So yeah, it's those kinds of techniques. Calculated rudeness is what he's calling it. Deviations from typical film craft. But for some reason, that's meaningless.
just a little bit afterwards, he says, the rare ability to conform punctiliously to the obligations of the idiom of naturalness in all branches of the cultural industry becomes the measure of expertise. As in logical positivism, what is said and how it is said must be verifiable against everyday speech. The producers are experts. The idiom demands the most prodigious productive powers, which it absorbs and squanders. Satanically, it has rendered cultural conservatism's distinction between genuine and artificial style obsolete. A style might possibly be called artificial if it had been imposed from outside against the resistance of the intrinsic tendencies of form. But in the culture industry, the subject matter itself, down to its smallest element, springs from the same apparatus as the jargon into which it is absorbed.
It sounds like saying that the individual artists are already brainwashed, so even if they do something that's supposedly true to themselves, like they're still being fake.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the secrets of the culture industry is everything appears to be new when it's not new. And the criteria for appearing new is to appear utterly natural, as if it's coming out of the wellspring of the freedom of the person who's producing it. But his claim is that that's all just a satanic veneer. Which is interesting because I guess the claim has to be something like we all as consumers and artists are so subjugated that we have no awareness. We really are in a kind of cultural matrix or, you know, in the cave and are unable to wrest ourselves from it, which is where the whole heart of the elitism of the article and the point of view comes from. It's just so hard to take, even when I recognize some of the points as being really important, is I feel like, well, so how is it that you see this and no other artist out there understands this or understands themselves as being, you know, part of a machine? And
wouldn't it be entirely typical for all historical ages that most artists are just regurgitating the stuff that they've heard and that it's only the exception that is creates truly great art in the way he's describing?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. Haydn was Beethoven's teacher, and he would write Dummkopf all over Beethoven's compositions.
What's that word mean?
Stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And Beethoven, of course, felt enormously competitive towards Haydn all his life, and of course, ended up being better than him. But that agonism, you know, where you want to be better than someone, I think is actually quite important to it being art. It goes hand in hand with the tension that Adorno is talking about.
I think one of the things we're having trouble with here, or that maybe you could accuse Adorno of having a double standard about, is novelty. That on the one hand, he seems to say that you strictly have to abide by the formula. That's what it demands. You would think, oh, it's just the audience demands that. If you had a movie where the hero just dies, you know, at least without it being properly prepared, then the audience is not going to be cool with that. They're going to object. But the way he's describing that is those are the expectations the culture industry has set up. And certainly back in the 1940s, we did not have a whole history of movies with anti-heroes and crap like that that you could draw on. And so whatever the patterns that have been set up there, you have to follow them. However, there's also this thing about novelty. I think Dylan was describing it as it has to appear as novelty. It can't really be novelty. So there's constant apparent motion forward, but actually it's just all the same stuff. That applies on page 109. I wanted to make sure we talk about this nonsense and humor. And the way he gets up to that is by talking about, well, the product prescribes each reaction of the audience. That is not through any actual coherence, which collapses once exposed to thought, but through signals. Any logical connection presupposing mental capacity is scrupulously avoided. Developments are to emerge from the directly preceding situation, not from the idea of the whole. So this already sounds like it contradicts the first quote that Dylan gave about the conception of a work of art is, hey, back in the Romantic era, they paid more attention to the individual effects and those overwhelmed the whole. But now in this postmodern age, the whole is very tightly controlled here. Well, he's saying, no, here, there's no plot which could withstand the screenwriter's eagerness to extract the maximum effect from the individual scene. Finally, even the schematic formula seems dangerous since it provides some coherence of meaning, however meager, when only meaningless is acceptable. Often the plot is willfully denied the development called for by characters and theme under the old schema.
Yeah.
Instead, the next step is determined by what the writers take to be their most effective idea. Obtusely ingenious surprises disrupt the plot. The producer's tendency to fall back perniciously on the pure nonsense, which as buffoonery and clowning was a legitimate part of popular art up to Chaplin and the Marx Brothers, emerges most strikingly in the less sophisticated genres. Whereas the films of Greer Garson and Betty Davis can still derive some claim to a coherent plot from the unity of the social psychological case represented, the tendency to subvert meaning has taken over completely in the text of novelty songs, suspense films, and cartoons. The idea itself, like objects in comic and horror films, is massacred and mutilated. And then he talks more about novelty songs here, but
you really are damned if you did and damned if you don't with Adorno.
Yeah. It's like,
because the first part of it really sounds like a critique of avant-garde cinema, right?
I guess that an avant-garde cinema piece would still be looking at the internal coherence of the thing as a whole and say what this requires is something that is not formulaic. But this is, we've got the formula, we stupidly follow the formula, but just like you're saying, content ultimately doesn't matter. Part of the formula can be to throw an expectation out the window, but not in a smart way, like a dialectical way. We just want a surprise. In crime and adventure films, the spectators are begrudged even the opportunity to witness the resolution. This sounds like he has seen early versions of noir films or whatever, where, okay, let's just end with everybody's dead, right? I don't know if there's a film from early 40s that follows that. Well, certainly every tragedy, he talks about tragedy later, but like in a crime film, can you just end in horror where the criminal has done something horrible and the police pull out and we're begrudged the opportunity to witness the resolution?
Typically not. Even in the noir films, the justice piece of it gets done in one way, shape, or form. What does happen in the noir film that sort of chafes against his thesis is that oftentimes you don't get the romantic consummation. You know, you have the hero and the heroine not coming together, or, you know, not having a happy ever after kind of thing. There was a different set of roles and archetypes that came out of that genre.
Yeah, I think even tragic endings would be a kind of resolution. So I wonder what he's talking about here.
The discussion of sex is right after that, and tragedy is not too far after that. Oh, no, the laughter is after the sex. Laughter is mostly page 112.
For me,
it always works.
Yeah, for me, it usually is. Yeah.
Hopefully, it's not before, right? Hopefully, it's just not laughing before
during,
sex.
And after. Not me, the other person. But,
yeah. He said, cartoon and stunt films were once exponents of fantasy against rationalism. They allowed justice to be done to the animals and things electrified by their technology by granting the mutilated beings a second life. I was trying to picture what he's talking about. He's talking about Bugs Bunny cartoons and stuff of,
yeah,
that you could have the TNT blow up in his face, but justice can still be done to the animals and things electrified by the technology by allowing it to not die right there. However, today they merely confirm the victory of technological reason over the truth. A few years ago, they had solid plots, which were resolved only in the whirl of pursuit in the final minutes. Really, he's being sentimental about cartoons from a few years ago and how they're not as good as now.
Well, he seems to be saying that, you know, like Tom and Jerry, they could do things where they basically killed each other within the plot, right? Do you remember that? And then they're resurrected, you know, for the very next scene.
But that sounds like what the thing he's about to say is bad.
That's the good thing. The bad thing is where you, instead of doing that, you prolong it and the protagonist is tossed about like a scrap of litter, he says. That's another non-resolving situation. And the ideological idea is that resistance is futile. Life is just a struggle. There is no ultimate resolution. And so you should just embrace the status quo, which is the struggle. So he says, quote, again, this is on page 110, hammer into every brain the old lesson that continuous attrition, the breaking of all individual resistance, is the condition of life in this society. I'm not sure which cartoon that was, but
Donald Duck in the cartoons.
Oh, Donald Duck, yeah.
And the unfortunate victim in real life receive their beatings so that the spectators can accustom themselves to theirs.
Did Donald Duck really get beatings in cartoons? Wasn't he a Disney guy?
Yeah, he was, but he was always the dumb one.
I guess the 40s were a little harsh. I don't know when Tom and Jerry came about, so maybe...
I just looked it up. Yeah. Tom and Jerry's first one was from 1943. Oh. No, earlier than that. So
maybe he might have been...
1940. Can I just say, just as an aside, when I was reading this, just because we had so many great quotes, I felt like I'd found the source of the way of speaking of every overly intellectual smartass you've ever seen in a film with a Marxist tendency. It's a caricature of itself.
It's not just that. It's the whole manner of speaking in large parts of the humanities, the social sciences and English departments. It's critical theory, and it dominates.
Well, doesn't he talk about the depiction of characters who have ideas in films is the way that they get neutralized? So the way that Dylan just put it is, whenever I see somebody in a movie that's talking like this, they sound... So it's that Adorno has predicted his own marginalization through depiction of beady-eyed intellectuals in films that you then don't identify with and you discount everything they have to say. So you've been ruined by films for this.
It's not quite exactly this kind of critical theory, but think about the scene in Good Will Hunting where Will confronts the guy who's hitting on a Minnie Driver's character, who's a grad student who's talking about history and says, you know, well, you know, if you'd read this book, and of course he's got a photographic memory, so he takes him down there and humiliates him. But that guy, this, you know, sort of long blonde haired graduate student who's pontificating about stuff, who's just an ass, that's like this whole thing. The manner of it, right?
You don't alienate a good portion of our audience. Come on.
No. I just found myself struggling with, on the one hand, finding things that were really both interesting and good points about the force of culture and the force of mass culture and the force of contemporary industrialized entertainment. But the rhetoric at times is so unmeasured, it feels like, that it becomes a caricature of itself.
I had very, very mixed feelings about this, and I'd read this, it's been quite a while since I've read it, and I hated it when I first read it, and I felt like I was wrong, you know, especially like for the first half of this before I just got tired of reading it. Just thought, wow, this is really chock full of insights, and I think it's a little overstated at times. Then by the time I got to the end of it, I just felt so much antipathy towards the writer that I had like a dialogue going in my head about the sort of refutations of some of these arguments. So, but especially, you know, as Mark put it, the sort of side explorations of, you know, you don't have to believe a word of what he says about the culture industry to be interested in this question, for instance, of tension in art and things like that. So it is full of such insights.
Well, let's talk about sex, which I think is just right on the next page or so here.
Yeah, 111. The culture industry endlessly cheats its consumers out of what it endlessly promises. So what it endlessly promises, right, is sex. It has that titillating element. Of course, it can't really deliver on that because then it would be pornography. Genuine art doesn't deliver that on that either, but what it does is sublimates it.
Genuine works of art were not sexual exhibitions either, but by presenting denial as negative, they reversed, as it were, the debasement of the drive and rescued by mediation what had been denied. That's a little hard to figure out.
The idea of sublimation is that you are repressing. You are repressing sexual urges, but they get channeled into the aesthetic. The beautiful is your expression of that. So that's formal, but you can't do that with the content. So if you're titillating people and having people in skimpy dresses flirt with each other on film, that titillation can't be really consummated aesthetically. You just deny the audience that consummation.
You suppress it.
Yeah, it's suppressed. It's alluded to, but you don't get any payoff aesthetically.
It goads the unsublimated anticipation of pleasure, which through the habit of denial has long since been mutilated as masochism.
There's no erotic situation in which innuendo and enticement are not accompanied by the clear notification that things will never go so far. The Hayes office merely confirms the ritual which the culture industry has staged in any case, that of Tantalus.
works of art are ascetic and shameless. And then above that, by constantly exhibiting the object of desire, the breast beneath the sweater, the naked torso of the sporting hero.
I think anything after masochism is not helpful. What is the Hayes office?
It's the censorship.
Okay.
I mean, I think the linking of it with the notion of Tantalus, right, is the kind of image that, I mean.
Tantalizing.
Yeah, and it's. And
seriously, it comes from the myth of Tantalus. Yeah. He was put into a situation where, wait, what is it, Dylan?
He's famished, dying of thirst and dying of hunger, and he's on a rock, and every time he reaches down to get a drink from the water, the pool dries up. And every time he reaches up for the grapes to get the food, it is drawn up away from him. So he's in a constant state of thirst and starvation with the remedy for that within inches of him. And when he reaches for it, it's pulled away. It's like blue balls all day long.
The way that Dorn describes this is that films reduce love to romance. Once reduced, much is permitted, even libertinage as a marketable specialty parade by quota with the trade description daring. The mass production of sexuality automatically brings about its repression. What do you think about that? The question always just seems to be like, well, what does that mean? Well, let's read the next sentence. Let's just keep reading the whole essay.
Well, the whole idea is that you start alluding to sexuality, but you can't fulfill on it. You go to the titillating route, but you can never go all the way.
What does that have to do with mass production, though?
The example I would think of is the reinforcement of cultural stereotypes regarding women as being the arbiters of sexuality. And so they're the ones, you know, you have the guy who's like sort of coming in, you know, all sexually energized, but she shuts him down, and that's the way it should be. And
yeah,
all kinds of puritanical notions about sexual relationships before and marriage and stuff like that.
But I also think mass production is meant to be in counterpoint to high art, where that repression is paid off in sublimation. So you don't just get repression, you get an expression.
You could probably say the same thing, even though Hollywood is not prudish anymore. Like, I heard basically the same review of this. I think I remember Siskel and Ebert reviewing like Porky's 3 or something and saying like all these kind of movies are just, they're saying exactly what is being said here, is they're kind of promising pornography, but of course they can't deliver on it.
They do deliver on it, though. You have exposed breasts and a lot of 70s and 80s movies. By the way, it doesn't happen anymore. I saw an article about this. There is no sex in movies anymore. There is no obligatory topless scene. Because of the ubiquity of pornography, its availability online, it's no longer necessary. It's not titillating.
So the fact that pornography is mass-produced, is easily available, does that mean the mass production of sexuality automatically brings about its repression? If that sentence is true, then that should apply now more than ever, because it's now way more mass-produced.
I don't think he means repression culturally. I think he means repression within the work itself.
I just don't understand the sentence. The mass production of sexuality within the work itself? No, the mass production is about how the work itself, extrinsic to it.
The idea is that in high art, sexual impulses are channeled into the aesthetic. In mass-produced art, you don't get that sublimation into the aesthetic. It's just repression. So it's the structure of the artistic piece itself. Both of them always have a sexual component. This is the Freudian theory. It's just that in one of them, it gets expressed and one of them gets repressed. Ironically, since you would think by, you know, having people in without a guy without a shirt on or a woman in a tight skirt, as he mentions, that is somehow less repressive, but it's in fact, it's more repressive. You know, in a 19th century novel, you don't see any of that, but it's still, on his view, sublimating sexual impulse.
Because you end up contemplating the pathos of the situation in the case of a novel, and in the case of a painting of a nude, you end up, even though it's presenting a sexual thing, following Kant, you end up contemplating it disinterestedly rather than using it as pornography. And so in that case, it's channeling the sexuality into, all right. So I just wanted to get some kind of example out there to see what he was talking about. I don't see why a film couldn't do that easily, but
yeah, I agree with you on that.
The reason that he gives in the next sentence, because of his ubiquity, the film star with whom one is supposed to fall in love is from the start a copy of himself. Every tenor now sounds like a Caruso record, and the natural faces of Texas girls already resemble those of the established models by which they would be typecast in Hollywood. The mechanical reproduction of beauty no longer leaves any room for the unconscious idolatry with which the experience of beauty has always been linked. It's not just that somebody appears in a movie with a tight shirt and then there's no sex after that in the movie. It's the extrinsic factor of it being mass produced. The fact that every movie has this. That it's not just, if you're just contemplating that one movie and only one of them existed like this, maybe that would be some sort of work of art. But it's the fact that it is such a freaking cliche that that's what supposedly makes it so that you cannot have an authentic experience at all. That you're kind of seeing through the individual thing that you're contemplating is just resonating in terms of the things it's an imitation of, which by extension is, like he says here, we even see things then outside movies as extensions of those things, that they're supposed to reflect each other. I don't know. I still don't completely see why this would mean you're repressing sexuality, but I guess.
Yeah. I mean, this is something about, so the, what he calls the unconscious idolatry. The idea is that idolatry, right? You treat the object itself as sacred. And so there's something about having a unique work of art, for instance, a painting hanging in a museum, as opposed to this thing that there are many, many copies of everywhere, and then films that are also essentially copies of each other in some sense. So I think he thinks there's something essential about that to beauty.
Hey, before we go on with that, let's talk about our sponsors. The first one being Casper, the online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because why, everyone deserves a great night's sleep, despite what the culture industry might tell you.
Apparently you deserved a great night's sleep so much that they sent you a mattress.
This is true. I have now been on this for several months, continuously. Well, during the night times, anyway.
Mark, I beseech you to get out of the house.
Are you in bed right now, Mark? Are you podcasting from bed?
I'm not set up to do that, but that's a good idea. I should definitely. It is comfortable enough. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly on to the consumer.
Uh-oh.
The mass consumer?
I'm not sure how I feel about that word after.
You as an individual consumer, it does not treat you as a, it does not force something upon you. This is internet.
The Casper bed gives you room for your subjectivity. It does not strip you of it.
You will not be buying this because of our advertisement. You'll be buying this because of your own free will. But you will be buying this.
Well, it's a comfortable mattress that provides just the right sink and bounce and provides long-lasting comfort and support. You can buy it online easily and risk-free. So this is why I think it is not like the culture industry forcing it upon you, because you have to go out, you have to log on to the website. It's not like going into a showroom and that's all you get.
The internet has freed us from mass culture.
Yes. The Casper offers free delivery and painless returns within a 100-day period. So you don't have to just lie down in a showroom. That's not going to actually tell you whether you're going to like this bed long-term anyway. Statistically, it has no correlation to whether it's the right bed for you. So you get the 100 days to try it out. That's pretty awesome. And Casper's mattresses are made in the USA. So get a Casper mattress for $500 for a twin or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. And you can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. That's casper.com/PEL, promo code PEL. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long science institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
So let's get back to the discussion here.
The issue about the mechanical reproduction of beauty is that it's doing two things. One is it's selling it as an unattainable ideal. So on the one hand, the presumption is that they're manufacturing beauty. They're taking somebody and they're creating an icon out of, in this case, he's talking about a her, but it could be a him. And there has to be some presumption that that could possibly be you. As a consumer, you have to believe that in some sense that could be you. And at the same time, it's not attainable. But as part of that mechanism, it also then fuels selling you whatever's in the gap between you and this unattainable idea. So the manufacturing of the beauty of the movie star is the building of the brand of the movie star, and it's also simultaneously the selling of the products that are used to manufacture the beauty of the movie star. And you buy into that, and you have to try to attain this ideal knowing that you can never actually get there. That's part of the cycle, and it's about that lack of fulfillment, the desire that can never be fulfilled.
Which I'm trying to connect this to the Fromm that we just did a few episodes ago. The way you're describing is, you know, you're treating yourself like a commodity, or do you think you have to improve yourself to match this artificial ideal? And it's entirely because of this conformity and all that stuff that makes authentic appreciation. Well, I mean, Fromm's point is authentic relationships, which is just a side product in here. But I believe Adorno brings that up too. It would follow that if you have these bunch of lies spilling at you from the media, and part of the grip of the media and films in particular are to make you perceive the whole world as an extension of them, as very similar in type to them, then you're going to have the same dysfunctional relationship to actual other people as you would to these individuals in the film.
Well, yeah, and it's also a mechanism to drive sameness. Mm-hmm. That if there's one ideal, one beauty ideal, and women from all over the country or all over the world are trying to emulate that ideal without being able to attain it, the consequence is that they're going to start looking the same. They're going to start acting the same. And it's just another mechanism for eliminating and erasing your subjectivity, your individuality and your subjectivity, and compelling you to the same. I think of all of the examples that he's given, and he's talking about film and jazz and all that stuff, we, you know, it's kind of questionable at points. But I think this is maybe the most relevant and strongest point that I still see echoed today, right? When there's so many issues right now in our culture about body images, and you see Hollywood starlets that are all being driven to have the same body morphism, and then simultaneously the magazines on the newsstands and the television shows talk about, how did they get there? How did she lose so much weight after having a baby? Blah, blah, blah. And while I don't think that maybe it's playing itself out in the culture and in the mass of women as much as he seems to think that it is, it's clearly the case that there's lots and lots of people that are being impacted, lots and lots of women in this case that are being impacted by those images and those characters that are being fed to them. I mean, it's a constant source of conversation, women's body images in the media, et cetera, et cetera. It's just flat out talking about that same function. And then he follows that up talking about laughter.
Yeah. I think that should be the next subject.
Well, it's funny how it comes straight out of this discussion of the mass reproduction of beauty. The triumph over beauty is completed by humor. This is still one page 112. The malicious pleasure elicited by any successful deprivation. There is laughter because there is nothing to laugh about. Laughter, whether reconciled or terrible, always accompanies a moment where fear is ended. It indicates a release, whether from physical danger or from the grip of logic. So there's going to be good laughter and bad laughter. Reconciled laughter, the good kind, resounds with the echo of escape from power. Wrong laughter copes with fear by defecting to the agencies which inspire it. It echoes the inescapability of power.
I love the phrase wrong laughter.
Fun is a medicinal bath which the entertainment industry never ceases to prescribe.
That's a great.
It makes laughter the instrument for cheating happiness. Right. The next thing he says, this is the weirdest part. To moments of happiness, laughter is foreign. Only operettas and now films present sex amid peals of merriment. But Baudelaire is as humorless as Holderin. So in other words, pure joy. He's just got this very culturally dependent. I mean, when I think of having a joyous time, yes, of course there's laughter. That's an essential component. But he's thinking of these sublime sorts of experience of, you know, when you're in church and you're singing Silent Night and it fills you with joy.
Well, not just that, but just the experience of beauty or sublimity that I think even Kant or Schopenhauer would agree with him. The laughter part is another charm thing. It's interest. It's what's interesting to us. And beauty is not what's interesting to us. It is what stands outside of interest. It's the formal aesthetic thing.
Yeah. What's so interesting about that is you would never on that delight in something beautiful because they would be antithetical to one another because there's nothing sublime about delight. It's almost not ironic enough in some funny way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on how you want to define delight. But yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah.
I would be with Mark and I would include delight with laughter. One sign of your delight would be your reaction of laughing.
Well, maybe that would be reconciled laughter, responding with the echo of escape from power. Because if really something is so wonderful and delightful that you're just like, ah, that's awesome, then you're not submitting. You're not.
Okay, it's
not,
I can buy that.
It's that the terrible laughter is basically gallows humor. You know, we might think that gallows humor is you're kind of rebelling. Hey, you can't keep me down. I can still laugh. But no, that kind of laughing, according to Adorno, is just you're accepting the inevitability of the situation.
But he's saying joy is austere. So I'm not sure he's associating joy with the good laughter.
Hmm.
Again, in the classic disinterested beauty scheme of things, I think it's hard to get laughter into that picture. And it's hard to even get delight, as Dylan was saying. It's hard to get any emotional, affective response. It's a very limited conception of the aesthetic, right?
In wrong society, laughter is a sickness infecting happiness and drawing it into society's worthless totality. That is a sentence.
This does get darker as it goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah. Joy, however, is austere.
Laughter about something is always laughter at it. Isn't that funny? The entire modern way that we say it, no, you could laugh with or you could laugh at. No, it's always laughing at. If you laugh with.
It's kind of true, though.
The way I was thinking about it as I was reading it was about how sort of like comic relief is inserted inappropriately into films these days, like where after the release of Fear, after a dramatic moment, they write in some kind of a comic line. So it gives you permission to not actually feel the emotions of the dramatic moment, but to release them through laughter about something else. And how that kind of use of humor and use of laughter in films diffuses any situation where you have to authentically, you know, come to grips with something. So that's kind of how I was reading this section. And I thought that tied into some previous comments he makes. I think it's around page maybe 110, where he talks about how the internal movement of the characters themselves would call out for certain kinds of developments which are ignored so that the plot can be furthered by whatever mechanism the writer or the director thinks is appropriate in order to fulfill the ideology. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah, it's 109.
Okay.
Yeah, often the plot is willfully denied the development called for by characters and theme under the old schema.
Right. So it goes hand in hand with this idea that this can't be too challenging because the idea is to have some level of intellectual amusement, which will distract from the working conditions of mechanized labor long enough so that you build up the stamina to go back and face it again. If I were to challenge you with a movie where I didn't provide a place for you to laugh as an outlet to diffuse either the severity of the emotional content or the severity of the intellectual content, then you'd actually have to like experience those emotions and think about it. And that itself would not be
tolerable.
It would not serve the purpose of trying to make you forget that you're part of the system.
Oh, I see.
Well, in the next sentence, he mentions Bergson. So we did a whole episode on that, so I have to read that. Laughter about something is always laughter at it. And the vital force which, according to Bergson, bursts through rigidity in laughter is, in truth, the eruption of barbarity. The self-assertion which, in convivial settings, dares to celebrate its liberation from scruple.
And abandons humanity. Parodies what is best.
Yeah. Well, this is the collective of those who laugh parodies humanity. The audience, you know, comedians always talk about how they love just like getting people to laugh and the fact that, you know, in a live setting and all these people are laughing together, how awesome that is. But no, the collective of those who laugh parodies humanity. They are monads, each abandoning himself to the pleasure at the expense of all others and with the majority in support of being ready to shrink from nothing. Their harmony presents a caricature of solidarity.
So I guess the comedy club is out as well for Friday night?
Yes, okay. The comedy club is seedy, and probably they have jazz so afterward.
Running out of options.
Wow.
Here's a perfect quote from later. The culture industry is corrupt, not as a sink of inequity, but as the cathedral of higher gratification.
So that's page 114. You know, at this point, we're getting this talk of, you know, he's not just criticizing low culture. So the sink of iniquity part, he's not criticizing culture industry as sort of the elevation of folk culture. The cathedral of higher gratification means that it's that synthesis of high art with folk culture and then the subjection of them both to the culture industry.
Just before that, on the bottom of 114, here's another one of his kind of aside. So he's given us like bad humor. However, amusement free of restraint would not only be the opposite of art, but its complementary extreme. Absurdity in the manner of Mark Twain, with which the American culture industry flirts from time to time, could be a corrective to art. The more seriously art takes its opposition to existence, the more it resembles the seriousness of existence, its antithesis. So in other words, you would think that art is supposed to be revolutionary the way he's lined it out, but if it is entirely serious in opposing the current status quo, then it kind of starts to look like the status quo in that the seriousness of existence and it are both serious. So maybe a little bit of absurdity of Mark Twain-y kind of, you know, Mark Twain, he's highbrow enough. We can bring him in here. He actually has nice things to say about circuses and just like complete nonsense. Pure amusement indulged to the full, relaxed abandon to colorful associations and merry nonsense. That might be actually something we could use that would let us really negate the burden of labor, not just, you know, have a reprise of it so we can go back to it. However, this is cut short by amusement in its marketable form. It is disrupted by the surrogate of a coherent meaning with which the culture industry insists on endowing its products while at the same time slyly misusing them as pretexts for bringing on the stars.
So it's this intellectualization again. You make it too coherent. You can't just be absurd.
So again, I feel like, you know, the Monty Python guys and the people that influenced them read this stuff. Or reacting to a culture of just the Bob Hope jokes are too predictable.
But not just that, he talks about stitching together the scraps of nonsense into a feeble-minded plot. So it's this idea that you even need a plot, that you need a coherent vessel to deliver these absurdities. But I think Monty Python does come close, at least their sketches, to being free of all that.
Or you could interpret them exactly in the way that the quote earlier was, that there is no overall logic. They look at how can we get into the next sketch and let's do like whatever our best idea is. So again, these critiques, they seem to cut both ways and be so flexible that you could use them to condemn anything. It's hard not to actually go right here.
Yeah.
But I guess the key is it is not the bells on the fool's cap that jingle, but the bunch of keys of capitalist reason, which even in its images harnesses joy to the purpose of getting ahead. There you go.
So the next phase is the fusion of high and low culture and the repetition of higher values in stereotyped form. And really, he starts to think about the sense in which this is all a vehicle for lies. So ultimately, what he's concerned about is truth and falsity.
Mm-hmm. Amusement itself has become an ideal, taking the place of the higher values it eradicates from the masses by repeating them in an even more stereotyped form than the advertising slogans paid for by private interests. Inwardness, the subjectively restricted form of truth, was always more beholden to the outward rulers than it imagined. The culture industry is perverting it into a barefaced lie. It now appears only as the high-minded prattle tolerated by consumers of religious bestsellers, psychological films, and women's serials as an embarrassingly agreeable ingredient so they can more reliably control their own human emotions. Let's unpack that a little bit. I feel like every time I get to the end of a sentence, you have to read the next one. Like, none of them make sense by themselves. He moves between topics so fluidly here.
Well, think about the transformation of, say, psychoanalysis into pop psychology. He even mentions that at some point. Again, he's thinking about this fusion of high art and entertainment. And it's not that he objects to entertainment, but it's, you know, you get these bastardizations and these hybrids. So religious bestsellers, psychological films, this fusion of the high and the low.
And it seems to be part and parcel to the way he described earlier. You take what were legitimate values in a previous time and you just cast them in stone and say, these are the formulae from now on. And in the same way here, you're taking, it could even be ideas from philosophy, and you put them in this different setting that makes them into lies. It's like that old cliche about, exactly. About how maybe the founders of the various religions really were wonderful and spiritual and in touch with deeper truths. But once their teachings get commodified, get mass produced into official religions, of course, they're going to be disastrous. To mass reproduce anything like that turns it inauthentic.
Yeah, when he says the subjectively restricted form of truth was always more beholden to the outward rulers, again, I think that's this idea of tension where it's a resistance to that. You know, my personal Christian conscience, for instance, in ancient Rome, something I could be killed for. When it just becomes popular, it can easily lose that character, right? It can just simply become the prevailing opinion to which you conform.
Yeah. And we think that inwardness, again, it's inwardness, the subjectively restricted form of truth, kind of what seems true to you when you reflect on yourself and you feel like, oh, I'm getting to my true self. No, that's always kind of a cultural matter. Well, it's always been a cultural matter, but now the culture industry is perverting it into a barefaced lie.
Well, in the first instance, it's resistance. It is a cultural matter, but like in the case of style, it's resistance to that force. Now it simply goes with that force.
That's right. I just think he's trying to claim a notion of authenticity that he's pointing to it being true in the past because of this tension, this resistance that is a kind of genuine nonconformity to now the whole notion of genuine nonconformity has been subverted by mass culture and the culture industry so that from his point of view, it's not even possible.
Well, we're getting into tragedy, which I think is probably a final topic to attack because at least it hooks up to past philosophers. He mentions Aristotle here in the very next sentence after we stopped. In this sense, entertainment is purging the affects in the manner once attributed by Aristotle to tragedy. The culture industry reveals the truth not only about style, but also about catharsis. It is by dumbing down, by presenting intellectual ideas and converting them to high-minded prattle tolerated by consumers of religious bestsellers, psychological films, women's serials, etc., as an embarrassingly agreeable ingredient. In other words, all that is noble, the noble philosophy, like where is like a real relationship with God, say, when you're confronting film? Like it just becomes like the stupid things that the priest character shows up spouting. There's nothing authentic about that. That is not actually spurring you to authentic religious experience. It's creating a caricature. It's creating a cliche that then you don't really listen to. You just put him in his little box. And somehow this is the truth about catharsis.
No, I thought that the culture industry was revealing the truth, not only about style, but also about catharsis. That just like in the case of style, where style is now prescribed and constrained by the culture industry, the same thing is true about catharsis. So it's not genuine catharsis, but it is whatever the culture industry decides it ought to be. It's not something that naturally arises out of the tragedy. It's a similar problem with the sublime that we were talking about before and confronting beauty and the problem of the aesthetic in the culture industry is that you no longer have that possibility. Sublimation is suppression, and he doesn't reveal what catharsis has actually become, except to say that, like with style, it is just defined by the culture industry as something that's being sold to you as, you know, sort of just another experience.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say what he's thinking about just based on the sentence with catharsis.
I was trying to link it up with what he said about style.
Right. Entertainment is purging the affects in a manner once attributed by Aristotle to tragedy.
But now I don't think he likes that In the context of this time in psychoanalysis, there are alternate theories to the idea that the purpose of tragedy is to purge the affects. I don't think he likes that idea. The point of tragedy is to confront the forbidden impulse.
Well, I know he says other things about tragedy here besides this sentence. Can we jump ahead to 122? I have notes here. Films can show tragedy, but they have to show compassionate people making it remediable. It's not that films just show everything as hunky-dory, but they can show necessary suffering. The whole point of the film, especially as distraction, or the culture industry's distraction, is to, we're saying how films are supposed to imitate the world. Well, they imitate the surface of the world. We've already established they don't make you think deeply. You can't have a philosopher. This is before my dinner with Andre. That would have been not even a legitimate movie, according to this analysis. That completely breaks the formulas of just two people sitting around and having a discussion about philosophy. That is not a legitimate type of movie. If you have philosophy in a movie, if you have deep thought in a movie, no, it's not deep anymore. It's just some cliche character that is having the deep thought. It's all about surfaces to make you not think deeply at all. And so likewise, if it shows tragedy, that's not supposed to make you then think deeply on your life and how it's an illusion of thinking deeply, but it's still just looking at the surfaces of things. It's that, oh, well, tragic things can happen in a world, but it's necessary suffering, and it ends up making the surface of existence look pretty.
Yeah. The point here is that in a typical tragedy, right, you have someone who's flawed under, you know, a certain theory, and then, you know, they end up dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of tragedy, it goes back to this idea of, at the very end of the section, he talks about tragedy being turned into a routine. And it's the valorization of what he calls healthy endurance. So the idea is you display tragedy not as this thing, again, with a consummation or an endpoint. It's the ongoing struggle of life, and you use it to valorize those who struggle. And the point is, again, the enforcement of the status quo. You don't get to defeat the system. The tragedy is just being in the system. You don't get completely crushed or killed by the system in a way of a classical tragedy, and you don't defeat it. So he has this line, tragedy included in society's calculations and affirmed as a moment of the world becomes a blessing. It deflects the charge that truth is glossed over, whereas in fact it is appropriated with cynical regret. It imparts an element of interest, the insipidity of censored happiness, and makes that interest manageable. So the other part of the function here is we're getting all these substitute gratifications. We're not getting the consummation of things. And we need something to make that interesting. So we have to valorize that as a heroic struggle. Tragedy in this kind of altered form becomes a way of amplifying our satisfaction of the crappy shit we get out of mass culture.
Right. And just continuing the quote, it consummates some of the earlier ideas here. To the consumer who has seen culturally better days, it offers the surrogate of long abolished depth. And to regular moviegoers, the veneer of culture they need for purposes of prestige. So this is the merging of the high art and the low art. To all, it grants the solace that human fate in its strength and authenticity is possible even now, in its unflinching depiction inescapable. The unbroken surface of existence, in the duplication of which ideology consists solely today, appears all the more splendid, glorious, and imposing, the more it is imbued with necessary suffering. It takes on the aspect of fate. However, then he says right after that, I mean, that still sounds like tragedy takes on the aspect of fate. That sounds like traditional Greek tragedy. However, here, tragedy is leveled down to the threat to destroy anyone who does not conform, whereas its paradoxical meaning once lay in hopeless resistance to mythical threat. Tragic fate becomes the just punishment into which the bourgeois aesthetics has always longed to transform it. The morality of mass culture has come down to it from yesterday's children's books. Nice. So it seems like there are two ways that you could have bad things happen to people in movies, according to this. One, it's just you're being punished for being bad. And so the lesson you're supposed to learn is conform, conform, conform. If you don't do that, then you'll end up like this. But on the other hand, the way you were just describing it and the way the earlier senses were describing it, Wes, it's like the cartoon where the suffering is extended as opposed to simply getting smashed by the hammer and then coming back alive in the next scene. Where it's continued, then it treats us to expect awfulness in our day-to-day existence and be okay with that.
Yeah, he says on the next page, 123, The masses, demoralized by existence under the pressure of the system and manifesting civilization only as compulsively rehearsed behavior, in which rage and rebellion everywhere show through, are to be kept in order by the spectacle of implacable life and the exemplary conduct of those it crushes. So you go into the movie theater and you see a story about someone who's heroic against all the forces that crush them. And you identify that with, in the sense of being, you know, you have your office job, your crappy existence, and that becomes a kind of heroic way of getting through things. It's an interesting idea.
So to kind of wrap this up, I mean, I know we didn't really get to in any depth or in many of the points here talk about, are these critiques still applicable to today? I guess it's been my claim through this whole thing that the critiques are irritating enough that you could apply them to anything. Yes, you could use them to condemn, I think rightly so, quite a lot of what's still going on today by saying that the culture industry, too much of it still is imposed from top down, and too much of our apparently spontaneous desires or creative impulses are because we are already have become sheep. And while I don't think this is unique to the modern age, I think that the technical means of mass production make it much easier for that to happen. It's not like you just go over to the next town and people think completely differently. And so you could sort of become worldly by exposing yourself merely to the people in the next town. Now, though there's a lot of sort of more prima facie diversity and things to look into, go to Zizek or somebody like that as a modern commentator on how ubiquitous the military industrial complex, the capitalistic system, still tends to just take everything that is thrown out of it and turn it into an image of itself, and how hard it is to think outside those boxes. And we ran into that, for instance, in our new work episode, when we try to think, is there a way that you could be? One of the points in this article that was brought up that we hadn't talked about yet is that problems are not admitted as legitimate. The culture industry has reduced our language, just like it reduces our ability to imagine. It reduces language so that problems like a tragedy here, the way we're just considering it, it has to be interpreted in terms of sort of the dominant paradigm, that either it's justice being done, that the tragic hero was bad, and so you learn from that not to be bad, or it's saying that even though things seem bad to you in your present life, that's okay. That's the human condition, and you should be okay with that. To think of outside that and think, well, how could we actually fix things? So tragedy is not inevitable. It's not fate. That would require some creative thinking that the culture industry, I don't know if I would, you know, I more think of it just in terms of politics or culture rather than manipulations of capitalists who run TV and film companies. It seems like it's more global than that. It's just the dominant forces in our culture make it difficult to think outside the box. So yes, that critique is still accurate today.
Yeah, his critique goes much further than that, of course, but
maybe the internet will eventually completely decentralize communications and all this stuff. But right now, just as he says, you know, there were ham radio operators back in his day, but they were condemned as amateurs. And even though we have the internet now, it's still like a few big companies and traditional media outlets, and maybe some things that were just penny ante things grow into giant media conglomerates, but still power tends to accumulate even in a distributed communications network. And so we're still going to have these sort of patterns that he picks out.
Yeah, I think there have always been concentrated power and dominant ideologies, though, that make people conform. So I don't think that's a particularly new thing.
Well, he thinks that technology is the end game of enlightenment, and industrialization in the form of capitalism is what's new.
Basically, it co-opts the struggle. Before you could struggle, now the struggle has been co-opted. That's the unique thing about mass production.
And maybe even if the content is different, it's the form of your behavior as a consumer that still is, hey, I can use my iPhone to look at any website I want. I don't have to look at just the CNN. It's still, you know, having to shell out money for this thing and then being attached to it physically, looking at it every 5 minutes through your day. This is you could update the critique.
Yeah. Self-distraction is a big thing. You know, you might think that there's some sort of political value, and, you know, I have my list of political websites that I go look at. I'm getting all this different range of points of view. But at a more structural level, you might just see it as me distracting myself for the sake of fitting into the hegemony. For the sake of being commoditized and
And it could be, I think I heard this in some YouTube video about this article or about the book in general, but that the fact that we know about these things, like, oh, I'm up on the news, I'm a Bernie supporter or whatever, that somehow makes me morally it replaces often actually doing something. Again, it's kind of the fantasy of being politically efficacious without actually doing anything. And so you could say that this whole media immersion still is a soporific that just makes you a better stooge of the capitalist machine.
Yep. Well, it's the whole mistake that educating makes things happen. Just because you know about it doesn't mean you'll do anything about
it. Well, I did start a hashtag campaign.
Yeah.
Seth, any closing thoughts?
Well, there's a lot going on here. And there are definitely a lot of references. So one thing that I want to return to very briefly was that I think I did a little extra research, and Adorno thought that art only had that its lack of utility is its purpose. And that once it becomes instrumental, or once production becomes instrumental, you no longer have art. And there was, I guess, some notion of instrumental reason and some other kinds of reason that are behind this. But the idea is basically that you have to have in the back of your mind this idea that art is somehow something different, and that culture is produced for a purpose, and that purpose is business. It's driven by capital. It's to make money. And I understand what he's saying, but I'm not 100% sold on the connection between the instrumental nature of cultural production in the service of capital, and then all of the erasure of subjectivity, the repression of resistance, the negation of the possibility of stepping outside or being outside. It feels intuitively, in some sense, that that's right. Like, it seems like we can see examples of that playing itself out. I suspect, however, that it's a bit more nuanced than that. As I'm reading this, especially in the section where he was talking about film, the film that came to mind as maybe something which simultaneously could be the greatest exemplar of this and then simultaneously might be a counterexample is the movie Cool Hand Luke, starring Paul Newman, where Newman is clearly an outsider who goes to jail for cutting the heads off parking meters. And it's never explained why he was doing that particular thing. And then once he's in prison, he just chafes against the restrictions and the rule of the somewhat aggressive warden and so on. And there's never any assimilation. He just simply is somebody who doesn't fit, and he consistently pushes against that. And it's an interesting study in the context of what this article was about, or this essay.
But he can suck a lot of eggs.
He just doesn't know how to communicate.
What we have here is a failure to communicate. But I very much enjoyed reading this. I'm looking forward to when we get to Habermas, to see how Habermas response. At least I understand he was at least in part responding to this in some of his essays. But this is a worthy reading.
Yes, so there are going to be more Frankfurt School ahead. However, next time we're going to pick up on a different thread of this by reading some Distinction, a Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste, from the 1979 book by Pierre Bourdieu. So more on the sociology of art. For an exact reading selection, which we just haven't decided yet, check out our new page, partiallyexaminedlife.com/upcoming, and you can read along with us. We are supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Lindsay Virgin, Sean Coyle, Daniel Hertz, Andrew Hanlon, Louis Lenzi, Reed Jacobs, Carlos Vieira, Jacob Meyer, John Michael Zorko, Limbu Sunil, Josh Weinstein, Al Gibson, Tanya Binos, Mariko Francis, Stephen Goodsell, Kian Guoyui, Kevin Hashman, Sharad Bharadwaj, Edward Cowan, Michael Hamalainen, Brian Cahill, Bukas Kilgore, Joshua Garrard, Brian Hawthorne, Michael Bates, Adrian Katz, Casey Machenti, Frederick Fortier, Jeff Chergosky, Susan Coleman, Stephen Robinson, Tom Vanden Bogard, Samuel Grun, Carrie Anderson, Jonathan Wolgan, Joel Rice, Marvin Farbman, Rex Carr Jr., Clinton Whitehouse Jr., Gabe Ormsby, Michael Potter, Cosmo Butita, Gregory Zalesnik, Amber McNett, and Todd Mercurial Chapman. Damn, thank you to all of you and the many $5 a month members of the Citizen site. You're awesome. And other folks, there's plenty of ways to get involved. You could go to our Facebook group, follow us on Twitter. You could read our blog at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Make sure while you're there to look at the posts for Nakedly Examined Music, my new music podcast, where has a lot of overlap with some of the discussions we're having here, but applied very specifically to specific songs. So subscribe to that.
Is there a link for that?
It's nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. It's also just one of the categories of posts within our regular blog. They're all on the same place. So there you go. Have a wonderful escape from tragedy. I hope we've served to distract you from the remedial badness of your life.
The mechanized nature of your labor.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
It's not just the places and things. The people I'm with are okay. My love's a spectacular thing. I would miss it if it went away. But something is wrong in the world. If you approach from my west, if anything's gone from the world, it's my impressions of bliss laid in tablecloths, fleshing what's new out of jetsam and dolly moths. I pass around, look at the ground. Nothing is eating the way that it should. Nothing is striking at sea level good. Why don't I win the new flash on the lawn? It's all too familiar. The thickness of sleep at the coming of dawn. It's all too familiar. Thought I'd never get tired of the street I live on. I'm tired of tired and resting up. I'm sick of falls and getting up. I'm sick and tired of letting up my guard, letting you in, and sick of pushing you out again. It's all too familiar. It's all too familiar. It's all too familiar. My God. I've seen this before when I was deep into thoughts. The patterns I found and from everywhere caught. The same checkered plaid I originally bought. It's all too familiar. I'm tired of tired and resting up. I'm sick of falls and getting up. I'm sick and tired of letting up my guard, letting you in. But don't think I'm pushing you out again. It's all too familiar. It's all too familiar. It's all too familiar. My guard. There's much to be gained from such realizations that magic tricks do not age well if left in the heat. Sensitive works only so many times. English does not offer infinite rhymes. Now I'll settle myself in the new way along the same street, which is all too familiar. Recognizing the style, that'll satisfy for a while. Adorno would crack if he'd seen all the leaving I've done. Adorno references aren't too obscure, are they? As I compress this mess into tunes fun for profit and fun. No profit so far, which is all too familiar. It's 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 all too familiar. My God.